This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's an update on Rivian Automotive. The company has stayed quiet since buying the Mitsubishi plant a year ago and has an even longer history of avoiding publicity.
Some people respect them more because they're not shouting from the rooftops before they actually have something to say. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that Rivian's been quiet.
EV watcher Chelsea Sexton also says people want to know what Rivian is working on, GLT's Ryan Denham reports. Hear from Brock Spak, ISU's football coach who has turned around the program. And it's a conversation with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner about the controversy at last night's council meeting about another scheduled meeting to discuss the library and downtown Bloomington. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's January 9th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The community's mayors join us on Sound Ideas most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. GLT's Ryan Denham is in the studio with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Ryan?
Downtown Bloomington was the topic du jour last night. Alderman got the final report from the Downtown Task Force. We'll get to that. There were some early fireworks, though, first during public comments and then during the usually uneventful consent agenda. So thanks for coming in today to recap the meeting, Terry.
Thank you very much. Good to be here, Ryan.
Alderman Kim Bray, who represents the city's east side, pushed successfully last night to cancel plans for a January 16th council meeting, which we were going to use to meet with Connect Transit and library boards to talk about the proposed Catalyst project.
And that's for the Downtown Task Force. So I'd slightly correct your statement earlier. The Downtown Task Force presented part of their plan last night. They were supposed to present the full plan last night and next week. It's the Catalyst project that they were supposed to present a week from this evening. And that's what was on, just by chance, happened to be on our annual calendar. And that one piece was pulled by Alderwoman Bray. She had concerns that a committee of the whole meeting take place on a Tuesday because of Martin Luther King's birthday on a Monday. Now, we do that pretty routinely for most of our meetings. I'm not totally sure why a committee of the whole meeting would be different, but she had some concerns about that, and the council, by 5-4, agreed.
And Alderman Bray has expressed some concerns about the library transit Catalyst project in the past. I remember a task force meeting that I went to. She expressed some concerns there.
Absolutely.
So what are your takeaways from last night? Essentially five aldermen or four other aldermen ended up joining her in that vote to pull that off of...
Obviously, I disagree with it, you know, and I think the main purpose was to not have a discussion, have information presented, I think. You'd have to talk to the five individual alder people to determine that. If that's the case, that's very poor communication. That is, we need to hear what Connect Transit has to say and what their needs are for downtown. We need to hear more from the library. We need to hear more information from the Downtown Task Force. We had nine people put in volunteer time for many months coming up with these recommendations. At the very least, I think we deserve them the courtesy of listening to their final product and their final report. And then actually we will, because I have already signed the papers before I came here to call a special meeting 1 week from this evening. And we will basically, we will have probably a little shorter meeting than we would have maybe initially planned, somewhere around maybe a 90-minute meeting. That's yet to be determined between Connect Transit and Library Board and the City of Bloomington. So we will have this information become public. I think it's unfortunate. From my perspective, more information is better than less. And I only found out about the possible proposal about 15 minutes before I came into the council chambers last night, and I think Amelia Burgess did. And in my State of the City message last night, I did stress better communication. That's not better communication. We all need to talk to each other. I don't know if Amelia Burgess, you'd have to ask her, felt sandbagged last night or anything, but that's not good communication. We should talk with each other. If we disagree, we disagree. If people don't agree with the Catalyst Project, and I think probably the majority of the council don't, that's fine. Let's at least hear what the needs are and why the task force that the council approved, this is not just a mayor's task force, it's a council approved, why did the mayor's task force that the council approved come up with these particular recommendations that happened to dovetail with the needs at the library and Connect Transit? And what are the costs of that? Again, at the very least, listening to new creative ideas is very, very important in making progress, I think, generally speaking. So bottom line is, that's the long answer, as usual, Ryan, I'm disappointed in last night's vote, but it doesn't mean I have the authority, in a sense, to override last night's vote, because I'm calling a special meeting a week from tonight.
So in subsequent conversations with any of the five aldermen who voted in that way last night, did you hear anything about their preferences for how they want to talk about this potential library transit project? Is it they didn't like the venue that was going to be set up,
in public at least, there were no opportunity, there were no options presented by those who voted no. And it would be nice if you vote no. Not always, but I think on most things, if you're voting no on something that's like a project, it'd be nice to have some sort of alternative. What other way would you like us to move, rather than to just oppose things? So if we had some positive ways that we might move forward, that might be useful. So, but regardless of last night's vote, the 5-4 vote, to say that we don't want to talk about it, we are going to talk about it anyway, because I'm calling a special, or I've already called the special meeting. I've already signed the documents. It will still happen 1 week from tonight, 5:30, Osborne Room. Everything else is still going to happen.
All right. So you've said you're personally open to talking more about this library transit catalyst project idea, but there now at least appears to be five aldermen who don't support it, or at least don't want to talk about it. So why doesn't the council just move on to other things? You've got a lot of stuff on your to-do list.
We have many things to do, but there are several things here. First of all, it sets a very, very bad precedent, and I don't think some of the council members, maybe the five who voted, all five, don't understand. If you ask people to commit their time and energy, you at least need to listen to what their conclusions are and what that evidence is. Secondly, we should never set a precedent where getting more information and getting more ideas and figuring out what our intergovernmental partners need is something we should shut down. We should never shut down conversations of new ideas and new information and data. The other thing that I think is important is that we should have an open forum where we also allow the public to listen to these conversations. Maybe the aldermen have made up their minds, but maybe the public hasn't made up their mind. So for a variety of reasons, we will still have this conversation. I do have this within my authority. I have already exercised that. Of all of my faults, and there are many, acting decisively is not one of them.
During your State of the City remarks last night, which opened the council meeting, you stressed the importance of the council working together. And then almost immediately, this issue pops up with the...
That was very unfortunate.
It's fortuitous.
Yes, fortuitous.
So it seems like there are still some unresolved issues on the council.
Let me make it quite clear. There are quite a few unresolved issues on the council. And that doesn't mean that one group is got a monopoly on truth and the other one doesn't. What I hope we all do is let's all check our egos at the door and work together and try as much as possible to get past any past acrimony that there might be, or feeling like you were blindsided, or feeling like you just don't like the way somebody's doing something. We're all human beings. We're all going to make mistakes. So I would say, let's all just work together. And that's easier said than done. Last night demonstrated that, unfortunately.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm joined in studio by Terry Renner, the mayor of Bloomington, who joins us most Tuesdays after council meetings. Another surprise, Terry, last night came during public comments. Developer Jim Pearson, who's also a planning commission member, pitched this plan that he has for a downtown hotel and conference center attached to the arena. What'd you think about what he had to say there?
Well, obviously, it sounds like it's an exciting, in a sense, set of projects. And I do know Jim Pearson. He's been a longtime member of the Planning Commission. I reappointed him. And I think he's also served in a local elected capacity in the Quad Cities area. So he's somebody with a lot of knowledge and a lot of great ideas. So the next step would be, though, for our staff to vet these proposals and to see if they're possible. One thing that we do have to recognize that Jim himself brought up last night is that control over the property is critical. Control over a mall or a strip mall is usually not much of a problem. There's usually one or two owners. A control over a downtown block or maybe a couple downtown blocks may mean you have a half a dozen or a dozen owners, and that can be a mess. And certainly in rebuilding and revitalizing Uptown, they've ran into that. We're running that into that into in revitalizing downtown Bloomington as well. So I look forward to our staff vetting this proposal and taking a look at it in more detail. I'd love to work with Jim on this. I hope that this turns out favorably.
And it seemed a little odd to me, at least, to have this kind of thing surface during a public comment. I mean, not that I love like backroom deals, but it seems like a more appropriate way for something like this to pop up. Did you know he was going to come speak to the council about this, or is this the first that you're all were kind of hearing about it?
Since I don't, I'm not the person who checks my city email every day. It is possible that there was some heads up there. So I did not know until Jim came forward. It is possible that he contacted people either by phone call or by email. But this might be the way that it's, sometimes it's just style. And I'm not going to hold style against anybody. So this might be just his way of saying, hey, this is a public splash. This is an idea. And I'm going to now circle back and work with staff on that. Frankly, from my perspective, however ideas come forward, if they're good ideas, if they're viable, let's move with them because that means we'll make Bloomington a better place to live, work, and play.
So what's the status of some of the other downtown hotel projects that have come up over the last couple of years? So the front and center version of it, the Pantograph Boutique Hotel version of it. Well, what about those ones?
Well, there were a couple actually front and center buildings possibilities. Both of those we rejected. And one of them would have been a $50 million investment, but we needed people to show that they were going to bring their $40 million if we were going to give them $10 million in tax rebates. And let me be clear, we would not be giving them any money that we are currently getting. The money would have to come by virtue of their investment. So the project has to pay for itself. There's not one penny of current taxpayer dollars that we would dedicate to that. Both of those deals were not deals we could accept. No matter how much I want downtown to thrive, we will not accept any deal. We've got to protect taxpayers. We've seen the price in the past 20 years or so or more where we've written contracts that did not pay protect Bloomington taxpayers. That's not happening under my watch.
A hotel is one of the ideas listed in the Downtown Task Force final report that was presented last night. But there's lots of other kind of lower hanging fruit in that report. Not nearly as controversial as a catalyst project.
And that's what mostly was presented last night.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that report will be ratified or formally accepted in some way by aldermen, or is it going to be kind of piecemeal?
It might be piecemeal. That's something I haven't circled back with Alderman on in the last however many hours since it is that we've met. Maybe it's a little over 12 hours. But it could be that the non-catalyst project is approved by the city council as a package. It could be that some pieces are. Some of the pieces have fiscal impacts that are more substantial than others. Some of them are very low-lying fruit. Some of them we could conceivably just turn over to Parks and Rec. One idea I kind of liked was making all of downtown a park and maybe having Parks and Rec handle everything. And that might be more effective than our current practices.
So much of the Downtown Task Force report focuses on placemaking. What are some examples of those that you like out of the report?
Well, one of them that I just mentioned, but also having artists painting over, for example, our electrical boxes. That that's win-win for everybody. Possibly closing off streets or the area, one or more blocks, or even if we don't close them off permanently, even if we close them off during certain times or more regularly, like the WGLT jazz concert, if we have more people asking for things like that, people are going to be more used to coming downtown. Obviously, GLTs is probably our most successful event, and it'd be nice to have some, have more of things like that.
You're just trying to butter me up, Terry. Come on. Uptown Norquist.
I think that's one of the first times I've ever heard anybody tell me I've tried to butter them up. But thank you, Ryan.
Uptown Normal has the circle, right? So I want to ask, what kind of public spaces are being talked about for downtown Bloomington in this task force report? I heard a lot last night about the front of the Law and Justice Center.
Front of the Law and Justice Center should be the low-lying fruit. And it's something that we should be able to partner with the county, even if we write most of the checks. It shouldn't cost a lot of money to – there's a big space there. It could be a big public space. That could be even a place where we don't have to close off streets for a jazz fest, or we don't have to close off streets for a blues fest, or whatever it might be. And it's a place that people feel comfortable coming to, but it does need lots of work. And in fact, I believe Alderwoman Amelia Burgess joked last night that she managed to find the least offensive picture of the current downtown plaza that she presented last night. So that is certainly, those are the things that are comparatively low cost, but could bring high yield as we move forward. Parking, changing from parallel parking that nobody really likes doing anyway to a diagonal parking gives us about 50% more spaces. And let's also be clear, there really isn't a parking problem in downtown. There's a parking perception problem, which, you know, we have to work on.
And do you think that increasing walkability of downtown would then kind of change that perception a little bit?
Absolutely. As well as we're in the process of acquiring strategic properties. Those I can't talk about. But as we acquire those, we will begin to alleviate some of the more visible parking issues and make downtown a much more viable and much more attractive place for people to come.
That's Terry Renner, the mayor of Bloomington, who joins us most Tuesdays after council meetings the night before. I'm Ryan Denham.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Advocate Charitable Foundation, which provides funding to help Advocate Broman Medical Center connect patients with world-class cardiology experts at convenient locations throughout Central Illinois. Information at advocategiving.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Ahead, it's a conversation with winning ISU football coach Brock Spack. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There aren't any Oompa Loompas or chocolate rivers, but the Rivian plant in Normal has a bit of a Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory vibe to it. Very few people on the outside know what's going on in there. That's about to change. Next month, the Economic Development Council will give its first formal report card to local officials who gave Rivian tax breaks to buy the old Mitsubishi plant. The public will also likely get its first look at Rivian's first vehicle, a truck, in the coming months. With the company still not saying much, GLT's Ryan Denham talks to electric vehicle experts about Rivian's prospects and its competition.
When Rivian Automotive bought the shuttered Mitsubishi Motors plant in Normal, the company's mystique was part of the excitement. Who is this MIT grad who wants to build electric vehicles here? What will the cars look like? Will it be like Tesla? 1 year later, Rivian is still a bit of a mystery, but not without good reason. GLT interviews with electric vehicle experts across the country reveal a hyper-competitive industry where startups regularly miss deadlines and often never reach full-scale production. And Rivian's founder and CEO, RJ Scaringe, has said he learned the value of silence after his company dramatically changed course 6 years ago, the same pivot that brought him to Normal. Here's Chelsea Sexton, a well-known EV advocate and industry watcher.
Some people respect them more because they're not shouting from the rooftops before they actually have something to say. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that Rivian's been quiet, but we do look forward to seeing what it is they've actually been doing all this time.
Rivian hasn't been completely silent. In December, the company revealed that its first vehicle will be a 5-passenger truck introduced in 2020, followed by a 7-passenger SUV. That's the same timeline laid out by Scaringe last year, when he said Rivian's first vehicle would begin production in 2019 and be sold in 2020. Here's a recent online video released by Rivian.
Soon after, we will launch new options for how you drive, own, and maintain your vehicle, and transform how you experience and explore the world. Fully connected, highly refined, incredibly capable. Rivian.
The public still hasn't seen the so-called adventure vehicles. Some Bloomington Normal officials say they've ridden in a prototype. Three pending applications filed by Rivian with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in the past year hint at what the vehicles may look like. One patent application shows a shape-shifting EV truck that can change its cargo-carrying capability based on a driver's needs, such as commercial deliveries or a pop-up roof for camping. In one patent application, Rivian says that conventional EVs have relatively low rates of utilization and are structurally and technologically limited in their applicability to different types of users. A reconfigurable vehicle would remedy that, Rivian says. Scaringe has not been available for media interviews recently. A spokesperson says he'll likely do some interviews in February. Rivian tweeted for just the first time last week. In a statement to GLT, Rivian spokesperson Samantha Flynn says the company is on target for its 2020 timeline. Flynn says Rivian has hired its core staff to maintain and evaluate the plant, grounds, equipment, and systems. She says the process is evaluating the production equipment is well underway, and the company is now determining the modifications required to make the plant production ready. One reason why Bloomington Normal is anxious to learn more about Rivian is because taxpayers have skin in the game. Unit 5 schools, the town of Normal, and other taxing bodies have agreed to a 5-year 100% property tax abatement if Rivian meets certain hiring and plant investment thresholds. The town of Normal also agreed to provide Rivian a $1 million grant once Rivian invests $20 million of its own in the plant. Rivian is also on track to receive nearly $50 million in state tax credits for the creation of 1,000 jobs over 10 years. If those jobs do materialize, Rivian would be one of McLean County's top 10 largest employers. To get the tax breaks, Rivian must provide local and state officials proof they've met those hiring and investment requirements. Rivian has provided the Bloomington Normal EDC with paperwork on expenditures and improvements for 2017. Kyle Hamm with the EDC says he expects to formally brief local taxing bodies on Rivian's performance sometime in February. During an interview on GLT's Sound Ideas in 2016, Scaringe said the Bloomington Normal community, not just the physical plant, won him over.
The community that surrounds this facility is really something special. If you look at other plants within the Midwest region and areas that have been affected by other plants shutting down or manufacturing moving out of the area, you don't have this level of energy, and you don't have this level of progressive thinking. And the town that surrounds this facility is just phenomenal.
Normal City Manager Mark Peterson says Bloomington Normal community leaders will likely visit Rivian's vehicle development facility outside Detroit sometime this spring. He says he's encouraged Rivian to provide an update to the community sometime earlier this year.
People are just curious, and they're supportive, but they really want to know what's going on out there. And there's a lot, I think there's a lot to talk about, because they have been working very hard the past 12 months. And I think, you know, some of the result of that hard work will become apparent fairly soon.
Rivian's history may explain its quiet 2017, because like many EV startups, Rivian didn't take a straight path to its current business plan. The company was founded as Mainstream Motors in Florida in 2009, a turbulent year for the auto industry. GM and Chrysler filing for bankruptcy, and a tough time to raise money for a startup. The company was renamed Avera Motors and finally Rivian in 2011. Scaringe earned a PhD in mechanical engineering from MIT. He was initially working on a fuel-efficient, not electric, car. That never panned out. At the end of 2011, Scaringe pivoted away from that original product and began work on EVs, subsequently lining up hundreds of millions of dollars from investors. It was an uncertain time for the company's direction and product strategy. Here's Scaringe again from 2016.
Really, because of, frankly, some of the things we talked too much about in the early days, we made the decision to go deep into stealth mode and to avoid the distraction of, you know, committing to things and making statements that were highly likely to change.
Ultimately, what Rivian says doesn't matter as much as what Rivian does. And it wants to do something incredibly difficult, become a full-scale EV automaker. So far, Elon Musk's Tesla is the only EV startup that's really done that. And even that company has faced significant delays and challenges. There's also increasing competition from Chinese companies and established American automakers. Tesla announced last month it too wants to build an electric truck. And the appetite for EVs among consumers is still limited. That's according to Jeremy Michalek, a professor at Carnegie Mellon and director of its Vehicle Electrification Group. He says only 1% of new vehicle sales in the U.S. are EVs. And here's Brett Smith, assistant director of the Manufacturing, Engineering, and Technology Group at the Center for Automotive Research in Michigan.
They, like a lot of others, are creating a vision and then trying to figure out how to fill that vision. And there's a real challenge with electric vehicles in that there's a remarkable interest, but there isn't necessarily a market for them yet. And the challenge for a small company like Rivian is, how do you bridge that gap between enthusiasm, vision, and real product, and real money, and real customers?
Rivian's investors are largely a mystery, with one exception, Sumitomo. The Japanese company with a U.S. operation based in New York announced in December it's now a strategic investor in Rivian. Sumitomo will, quote, support Rivian's business development through its network in North America and its supplier relationship, where Sumitomo has deep business experience and relationships across the world. That's what the company said in their December statement. Sexton, the EV advocate, says many EV startups make the same mistake, underestimating the amount of capital it'll take to launch a brand new car. Even Tesla's delays have raised concerns about whether it will need more cash.
Automotive is a hugely capital-intensive industry. To build product, to comply with regulation, to do crash testing for liability, sales and service, after sales, you know, all of the basic retail and service infrastructure that's required after you put cars on the road, and things like, you know, roadside assistance, all of that stuff that you think about when you buy a car, what all the ecosystem that comes with it, it all costs a tremendous amount of money. And folks almost universally underestimate that cost when they get into this game. Even startups that are composed, as Rivian is, by some veterans of the industry.
One advantage Rivian has is its own manufacturing plant. It bought the plant and its contents for $16 million. Rivian is expected to invest $175 million into that plant over the next 8 years. But even that advantage doesn't make Rivian a surefire success. The startup hybrid automaker Fisker got help from state and federal taxpayers to buy an abandoned GM plant in Delaware in 2009, but Fisker filed for bankruptcy 4 years later without ever building its car or bringing promised jobs to Delaware. Here's Chelsea Sexton.
On one hand, we all cheerlead. We all keep fingers crossed. We all want to see EVs succeed. We all root for all these companies. And at the same time, we all have to be fairly realistic about the chances of a brand new auto company succeeding on its own without being, at a minimum, acquired by a larger one.
The best clues about where Rivian is headed might be found in the people it's hiring. Rivian has about 250 employees across the country. That includes 27 based in Normal, including a dozen former Mitsubishi maintenance staffers who've returned to their old plant. Peterson says Rivian also recently hired a local plant manager. Rivian is now hiring for manufacturing workers in Normal, too. The company's not required to meet any local hiring thresholds until the end of 2018, when it must have 35 full-timers to get its tax breaks. Rivian tells GLT it expects to meet or exceed its job creation targets for 2018 and 2019. Its other teams are based in Plymouth, Michigan, where it has vehicle engineering and design, Silicon Valley, California, where it has self-driving technology and connectivity workers, and Irvine, California, where its battery system development team is based. Kelley Blue Book managing editor Matt DiLorenzo says the geographic footprint there is a good sign.
The Rivian certainly has centers in places where it lends some credence to their business plan. It seems like they're drawing on the right centers of expertise for whatever they're doing.
The company's website now lists the full leadership team, including many executives with extensive experience in the auto industry. Meanwhile, Rivian's focus on self-driving vehicles, also called autonomous vehicles, is one that other EV car makers have tried, notably Tesla and its autopilot feature. Here's Scaringe last year.
Our first product is something that does exist in an ownership-centric world. So you can buy it, you can use it 3% of the time, but we've also provided mechanisms whereby you can share it and you can access it.
So
our follow-on products really take the next step, and these are products that are designed purely for mobility as a service. And the nature of these products are going to be complementary with the first set of products, in the sense that you may own one of our launch products, is sort of a weekend vehicle, something you really engage with. It's fun to drive. It's highly efficient. It's got a ton of utility. But then, you know, for your weekday mobility needs, you use a Rivian mobility service.
Jeremy Michalek, the Carnegie Mellon professor, says there are many reasons why self-driving vehicles and electrification make sense together.
If you can get to the level where the vehicle can go out and refuel itself and come back without a driver in it, that's particularly nice for those potential future buyers who might not have off-street parking at home. For example, if you live in a dense area of the city and rent, you might not really have the option to have your own personal charging station. But if the vehicle can charge itself, that suddenly opens the market to a set of people who wouldn't have been interested in electric vehicles otherwise.
2018 could be a big year for EVs. Tesla is expected to ramp up production of its first mass-market EV, the hotly anticipated Model 3. Jaguar, Audi, and Hyundai are also releasing new cars. Brett Smith from the Center for Automotive Research says there's a lot of hype around EVs, but that doesn't make the hype empty.
There's a lot of challenges between now and a mass-market electric vehicle fleet. But things are happening, and it's really a fascinating time to watch this industry because of companies like Rivian, because of guys like RJ who are creative, trying to push things, thinking outside the box, forcing the big industry to think outside the box and come up with solutions. It's just a lot of fun to watch. I'm not sure how successful a lot of these companies will be, but they're really making the industry think, and I think in the long run, making them change.
I'm Ryan Denham.
In a statement, Rivian says it's already begun supporting local community initiatives. The startup says it's donated forklifts to several school districts and the Midwest Food Bank. It has also hosted the Ecology Action Center's Household Hazardous Waste Collection event and BN Beyond the Business luncheon last summer. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
With a new year comes new opportunities. Opportunities to stay in step with what's going on around the world.
The largest demonstrations in Iran in nearly
opportunities to learn.
The main reason for the surge has to do with global economic
and opportunities to be surprised.
Kahlua, chocolate syrup, and red Kool-Aid.
All you have to do is listen. Tune into Morning Edition every day.
Here, Morning Edition, Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
An art exhibit currently on view in Normal is a two-artist show that highlights a shared visual vocabulary. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
Sensing Synonyms is the latest exhibition up at the Joe McCauley Gallery at Heartland Community College in Normal. The show features the work of Whitney Johnson, a recent Illinois State University graduate and an art instructor, along with Alyssa Palmer, a current ISU Fine Arts student. Curator Danelle Dvorak invited them to show together as their works shared sensibilities, both tactily and inspirationally. Johnson says their mingled artwork just naturally creates a conversation between the pieces.
It starts with a visual.
Yeah, yeah. And then also, I remember we came up with like a list of adjectives. We like sat down, and the way that we were trying to think of overlaps was through language.
So that's why it's sensing synonyms?
Yeah, the language part's kind of a funny thing. But yeah, visually, I would say both of our work is really tactile. I think that's pretty important. And the ways, like our processes. So even though we're thinking about separate things as we're working, or we have different inspirations that come to us, I think the feeling of materials is really important. The title of the name of our show, Sensing Synonyms, you have to sit with it, pause, and that's hopefully what we would like people to do with our work as well. Like, pay attention, pause, sit with it, think about it for a bit. It's not a name that you can just like say super fast. I wanted the material to be just as important as the content on top of it and not just be used as a surface only and solely to be seen as that. So the fabric was a way for me to start testing that out and then dyeing it in different ways, like this one with this weird like orange color. This was actually a green sheet that I cut up and now it's orange. But and playing around with those things, I really like warm tones, like things that kind of remind me of skin.
And everyday imagery as well. I see a couple of forks here. I see that's a can actually, of deep woods.
Yeah,
off.
And that's where we start combining Whitney's work with mine, because hers, and that's the funny thing, people might not be able to tell whose is the deep woods and the forks are Whitney's pieces.
Those are your pieces.
Yeah.
Okay, this is really interesting, you guys, because there aren't any identifiers here at all. I want to know, how did you decide what goes next to what? Mm-hmm. How do you decide the group? How did you negotiate that, Whitney?
Wow. It took a while. It was a process. Mm-hmm. So we laid things out on the floor and tried to find relationships between them.
I would say color, but also like random shapes. So
yeah,
one that was really important was this yellow, little tiny yellow piece here has this cool bleed off that's almost the exact same color as that sheet.
So it's a natural lead over to the next thing on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah, we wanted to feel more like they were connected instead of separate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what are you exploring in your works, mm-hmm. Alyssa?
I'm really interested in painting figures and thinking about things like memory and home. I would say I'm really interested also in a sense of the word touch. I keep going back to the word touch, so the way that I use materials.
Well, they're so tactile. I just want to touch them, and I know I'm not supposed to.
I'm also trying to dab into like using words in my work, so like poetry, to help me think that out as well. I guess that would be an easy way to start explaining it. I source from Polaroid pictures solely that I take. There's a lot of really interesting things that happen to the film. It's never perfect. I don't like creating the perfect image. I like things to feel
like they're still developing.
Yeah.
Like a Polaroid
like still
picture.
Developing. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Whitney, tell me about how you draw your inspiration.
It starts from somewhere in the world, like some sort of experience in the world. And then it morphs somehow in my head and in the studio too. So I have these memories of seeing something or being somewhere or touching something. Mm-hmm. And then I get in the studio and have to find the things that can convey that feeling in a way.
Yeah.
So I'm always searching through my studio, like digging through scraps of anything.
That seems so challenging because you're not trying to convey an image, you're trying to convey a feeling.
And I think that's actually where our practices overlap. It's the process, because in the same way that like Whitney looks through scraps and things in her studio, I also have a bunch of scraps of paper everywhere that I look for. And I would say that searching constantly, like in the studio, is kind of where we both intertwine, like the process of doing that. Even though I'm looking at an exact image, I know what I'm sourcing from, whereas hers is like more of like a sense of what she's searching for.
That's artists Alyssa Palmer and Whitney Johnson. Sensing Synonyms runs through January 26th at the Joe McCauley Gallery at Heartland Community College in Normal. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see a gallery of photos from the exhibition at our website, wglt.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, offering Reduce Shakespeare, performing Shakespeare's long-lost first play, a funny and fictional weaving of famous speeches and plot devices from the Bard's works, Friday, January 19th. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. When Brock Spack was introduced as head coach at Illinois State University in 2009, only two coaches in the previous 100 years of the program had compiled winning records. In the 32 years before Spack arrived, ISU had only 9 winning seasons. Under Spack, in 9 years, the Redbirds have amassed a 68-40 record and made 4 appearances in the Football Championship Series playoff, highlighted by a trip to the national championship game in 2014 and a second-place finish. GLT's Brian Bloodworth
Woodworth talked with SPAC and others to find out how the program has risen to national prominence in the FSC ranks. And in spite of the lack of program success at ISU, SPAC says he felt sure the program would grow to its present state.
Yep, I did. And I still think there's a lot of untapped potential here. You know, as I said, a year after I took the job, there's more ceiling to go, in my opinion. I guess there's more to be reached. There's more to be done that could make it even better than it is today.
Patty Viverito, who has been the only commissioner of the Missouri Valley Football Conference since its inception in 1985, said ISU had always been known as a basketball school before Todd Berry arrived as coach in 1996 and planted the slow-growing seed of success that SPAC has cultivated during his tenure.
Todd Berry, when he was coach, that brief period of time, but I think he made that community believe that Illinois State could field a successful football team that the community would support. He had folks excited about it. You know, there have been glimmers of excellence along the way. He certainly made me a believer.
Well, what was it that Illinois State did to get where it is today now?
They believed. There were flickers of hope. You know, Illinois State could be not just a basketball school, but one that excelled across the board, including football. Shayan being a football guy and Al Bowen being the visionary that he is was the perfect combination that the university needed to make a commitment to that program. And, of course, the stadium was a game changer, and hiring Brock was also a game changer.
Al Bowman became president of the university in 2004, and he admits he had a different view of the football program when he was just a faculty member.
I went to the occasional football game, but it just didn't resonate with me to a great degree, and I think that was probably true of most of my faculty colleagues. ISU has been known as a basketball school for many, many years, and most of my faculty colleagues were avid basketball fans, and football just didn't resonate with the campus the way basketball always has.
But as you became president, the importance to football took a swing.
I began to recognize an elevated football program could bring visibility to the campus. After hiring Shayan Zinger as the athletic director, we began to talk about what we could do to really make football competitive, to get people engaged in our Saturday games, and how we could use football as a kind of community outreach, get people in the community excited, alumni about coming back for Saturday games, tailgating. One of the things that we did early on is we changed the rules on tailgating. We allowed people to consume alcohol and really just kind of created the kind of atmosphere that people have come to expect at college football games. Fans responded. People started coming back. We saw lots of involvement from the community, especially with the Comm University Day. And I think Dr. Zinger and I saw it really as an opportunity to showcase what Illinois State had.
And I'm sure you met some resistance along the way.
There's always resistance. You always have to answer the question, how much are we spending on athletics? Are we spending too much? Are those expenditures taking away from what we could be doing on the academic side? And I think we had good answers for those kinds of questions. We don't use any state money for athletics. There is some student fee money involved. But I think the expenditures on football and athletics in general at Illinois State, I think, are reasonable. You could certainly spend a lot more in their institutions that do. But I think for our size and for what we see in athletics, I think we're at the right level.
Bowman hired Shayan Zinger as athletic director in 2005. And by 2009, Zinger was ready to make a coaching change and fired Denver Johnson and hired SPAC, a move Bowman said was the turning point.
I give all the credit to Shayan Zinger. He came into my office one day and said, I think I found the right football coach for us. And he said, let's get in the car, let's drive over to the Beef House in Indiana, have dinner with him, and just see what kind of chemistry there is. And after talking to him for 5 minutes, I knew we had the right man for the job. He had the right values. He understood the place of football on a college campus, the expectations he had for the behavior of his players fit right in with the culture here at Illinois State. He's done a remarkable job. You know, the success he's had at a school that really didn't have a history in football is incredible.
Zinger agreed. Hiring Spack was a no-brainer.
You know, Brock was such a good fit being from Rockford and having, you know, the experience at Purdue all those years, which is right next door, and even some history at Eastern Illinois, and he was such an Illinois guy that had such a great football background. It all just came together.
He was the big part of it, though, wasn't he? He was the key to kind of get it going.
He was, and that doesn't, you know, give Todd Berry and Denver credit. They both had their moments also. But Brock's been able to build it, and we were able to start to give him the facilities and resources he needed. And then after I left, then Larry and company have been able to continue with that, obviously.
The ISU job had been on Brock Spack's radar for a long time. What were his initial impressions of the university?
We kind of apologized who we were around here. And Illinois State shouldn't apologize themselves for anybody. You know, this is a great place, and particularly football. You know, it's untapped. We don't have to apologize. You know, now we've played for a national championship. We've won two Missouri Valley titles. You know, we were a game away from North Dakota State being a championship game again. And that'll be the fourth or fifth time since we've been here. But that's where we should be playing in late November for a championship. That's who we should be. But we should win them too. I want to win those things.
What did you see as the key components that you had to have or that had to change?
A mentality, a culture needed to be cultivated here. And I think that's, I'm not talking about facilities or any of that, just the culture needed to change, particularly how Illinois State football players or football program viewed their education. I think we needed all to change our view of what our role was, not just on the field, but in the community and on the field and in the academic side, that there was a standard that was going to be set that needed to be reached. Now, it's not perfect every year. We always, you know, when you have 100 plus young men, they're going to make, you know, they're going to do stupid stuff every so often. But I get that. But overall, our mentality should be, hey, we need to conform to what the university sees us. You know, we can't sit here and recruit guys that don't fit in what the university sees, you know, the kind of student that should be here. There are exceptions, absolutely. But those exceptions have to be going on an upward trend when they come in here, or it's not going to work. And now there are mistakes made every year in recruiting, but we work very, very hard to try to avoid that. And the least amount of mistakes, the better, obviously. But I want guys that fit the blueprint of the university first, and then in our football program. I think that was key. And I think our faculty needed to know that, and our administration academically needed to know that we were going to abide by the culture of Illinois State University and try to get kids in here who could live in that culture. Is it perfect? Are we perfect every year? No. And we recruit a lot of guys, and it's hard to, I'm not trying to make excuses, but it's very difficult to get everything perfectly lined up sometimes. But I think the university has worked with us, but I think our relationship with our faculty has been outstanding. And I think that's critical for this to work, because I think our faculty is so good, and they work with all our students, but they're always working. I have very few instances where I think if a professor hasn't tried to work with one of our players, you know, and working with and making them earn the right way and learn the right way is important. You want to use football, you don't want football to use you. And I tell our players that all the time. And I think that was the untapped resource here was the people that were already here and the community. You know, and our school is such a good school. And I think basketball and football can live, have a cohesive existence. You know, we're all on the same team. We get a lot of cooperation. I love the faculty here. The administration, from the athletic administration to our campus administration, has been very, very supportive. What I like about Illinois State, we're never going to sacrifice academics or our integrity for a championship or for a player. We're going to always, you know, try to do the right things. You know, we sometimes it always doesn't work out, but we try to do the right things, and that's important. I'd rather have that, and it's kind of where my background comes from. You know, I don't think you should win at all costs. There's some people, I guess, across Division I athletics that will try to win at all costs. I just don't think that's the way to go. And it's about the student athletes, about their experience, about making them ready to move on after they're done competing. It's trying to become the best program you can be. So I think that's what makes our place very different than a lot of places in the country. It's just because, yeah, everybody wants to win here. There's no doubt. I mean, we all want to win. And no one puts more pressure on us than us and me. You know, it's the expectations are off the charts from me. And so, and I think that but I don't ever want to, you know, I want to be able to look myself in the mirror and go to bed at night rest assured of doing the right things.
Is the program where Bowman envisioned it would be when he hired SPAC?
It's exactly where I thought it would be today. What I hope continues in the future is I hope the fan base grows. If the fan base grows, then we can entertain the notion of adding seating. At some point, you know, I'd like to get to the point where most of our games are sellouts, and it's a tough ticket to find.
The program went from obscurity to now it's one of the top 25 programs in the country and has been in the playoffs a number of years. Did you envision that, too?
No, I didn't see that coming. Once we saw what Coach Spack could do in terms of recruiting, then it became clear that he could really build something that would continue with success for many, many years, and that's where we are.
And Spack is by no means ready to rest on the program's laurels.
Very proud of a lot of our accomplishments, but I'm very hungry for more, I guess, is the way to put it. I'm very, very hungry. I really don't sleep much at night, knowing that, you know, there's more to be had there. So we're grinding it out, and we're already started on 2018, trying to get, you know, be in a championship football team.
You heard ISU football coach Brock Spack, MVC president Patty Viverito, former ISU president Al Bowman, and former athletic director Shane Zinger talking with GLT's Brian Bloodworth about ISU football. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.